This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. In early 2014, more than 50,000 children from Central America made their way to our southern border. They were undocumented minors, most of them fleeing violence in Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala. Wildon Acosta was one of those children. He says he left Honduras after a gang called Barrio 18 sent him an ultimatum: join us or die. He traveled alone over nearly 2,000 miles to reach the U.S. border and then was sent to live with his family in North Carolina. Earlier this year, Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers detained him at his home in Durham. He was one of a handful of people in North Carolina who came here from Central America and have been detained in the last few months. It's part of a directive from the Obama administration to target people who arrived here illegally after January 1st of 2014. I'm joined by Leila Santiago. She's a reporter for WRAL-TV. She's been following this story since the surge of unaccompanied minors started in 2014. Leila, welcome to the program. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Take us back to 2014. What was happening at the border at that time?
So at the time, we saw what we always see: people crossing the border illegally, some from Mexico, I remember seeing people from Cuba. But really, the bulk of it was children from Central America, and particularly that northern triangle. So we're talking about Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador. And not only were these children coming, these were children coming alone. I mean, a two-year-old crossing that border without a single parent by their side.
So why was that? What was happening around that time to cause so many unaccompanied minors to go to our border?
Right. So you look at immigration as an issue, right? You've got the pull, the push-pull. You know, you've got the pull from the U.S. that there's that promise of a greater life. The push from Central America at the time and still today is violence, that gang violence. This is the murder capital of the world for countries not at war.
Central America.
These in particular, yep. Honduras in 2014. I believe now that has changed to El Salvador. I mean, so when people are threatened with, much like Wildon Acosta, join us or be killed, I think it's reasonable to understand that there would be a desire to leave.
So we saw this push all of a sudden, and of course we know the headlines were full of stories about unaccompanied minors and what to do about them. Already there had been stories about families who had been detained crossing the border, and they were in detention centers. Many of them are still there. What was happening to the unaccompanied minors if they got caught?
So initially, and understand that when I speak about the Rio Grande Valley, because that's where the majority of my reporting took place. And quite frankly, that's where we were seeing the majority of the children coming in through that area of Texas. And many of them at the time were going into the McAllen Border Patrol facility, so much so that they couldn't handle them. I mean, these were rooms that were overflowing. I mean, at some point there were some leaked photos that came out showing children in the hallways because they couldn't keep them in the cells. So eventually, months later, they actually built a facility that was solely for unaccompanied children. Now, today, that still exists, but now they are housing families. It's not just for kids. The numbers have gone down. They're actually back up again. But they actually ended up having to take them out of what they, for years, have been using because they just couldn't handle it.
And again, why detain them? Why, if they without documentation? I mean, I guess the options are turn them around, send them back. They didn't do that. They detained them. What was the rule about, or were there particular rules about unaccompanied minors?
Right. So if you go back to 2008, you know, George Bush is president. He signs what's called, or he enacts what's called, the anti-trafficking law of 2008. And pardon me, that there's a longer name for it, but that's what I know it as. And it basically says any child that crosses that border alone, so an unaccompanied minor, and if that child is not from Canada, is not from Mexico, that child is guaranteed a day in court. So if you're from Mexico, you're going back, assuming that they don't believe you have an asylum case that would move forward. So you stay, if you're from Central America, you're guaranteed a day in court, an immigration court. And so that means you come in, they process you, there are health screenings, there are certain things that they go through, and then you're given a court date. and you are to go see an immigration judge before your case is decided.
And that case would be whether or not you would be granted asylum because there is a reasonable threat to your life if you were sent back. And that's sort of enshrined in the law. You need the day in court to determine that. That's all going on. To get a sense of how dangerous it was, you went down to that area, you did some coverage, and you looked at certainly on the U.S. side of the border. You talked to a ranch owner named LaVoyager Durham. Tell us his story.
So LaVoyager has been there for, he's been there for more than 20 years. And LaVoyager has unfortunately come across bodies, multiple bodies. And he ended up putting out a water barrel because there were just so many people that were dehydrated and in such bad shape. He got tired of finding bodies on his property, on this ranch that he runs.
Let's listen to a clip of tape that you got on your reporting along the Mexican border.
You must remember that some loved one, you know, wherever he was from, lost a loved one, and they don't even know it, and they might not ever know it. And whether it's legal or illegal, I think it's they deserve some dignity. These are all fresh water jugs full of water. I usually put about 10 or 15 in here.
Do you consider the fact that you give them water and you might help them out, is that assisting them?
Oh, I get criticized for saying that I aid and abet them. And I tell them that I've got this water station because of the five dead people that I've found. And I've got a heart. I've got pity and I've got compassion. I don't want people to die on this ranch that I run. No.
That's LaVoyager Durham, who's a ranch owner in Texas, from 2014 documentary Journey Alone, produced by WRAL. And my guest is WRAL reporter Leila Santiago. So he's talking about the people who don't make it. Mm-hmm. Wildon Acosta was one of the ones who did make it successfully. He crossed the border and then eventually was sent to live with his parents in North Carolina. Tell us more about his story.
So Wildon ended up, he crossed in 2014. He ends up in Durham. And like anybody else who crosses and comes across Border Patrol, went through the exact same process. He was given a date. He was told, go see the immigration judge. According to his family, he did go to that first hearing. And that's, it's like you would find in any other courtroom, you know, hello, you're here, I'm the judge, find a lawyer, here's your next date. And that courtroom is for unaccompanied children here is in Charlotte. He went to his first one, feared deportation, and never went back. And that is actually something that is very common. And because he didn't go back, he received an order of removal. And as a result, is now facing deportation. And in that Charlotte courtroom, something that's very interesting, 90% of the removal orders are cases just like Wildon. They are in absentia. So they are people who, their cases, yes, they had an opportunity. Right. But they were never really heard in front of a judge. Now that is their decision. I don't want it to seem like I'm choosing one side or another. But I do find it interesting that many of these cases that may have potential to be asylum cases are now falling into a different category simply because the person doesn't show up.
Well, the court rules that the fact that you didn't show up, that ends this case. It's been adjudicated. And that gets into the enforcement part of this, where ICE was ordered to, on the Obama administration's directive, look for these cases that have been adjudicated and send these people out. Wildon is a 19-year-old. He's going to Jordan High School, and he gets caught.
He's going to Riverside High School.
Riverside, I'm sorry. Yeah, Riverside in Durham, yes. Thank you. And so now he's in a detention center in Georgia.
Right. And he went through, again, the same process. He was on his way to school. I believe he went outside, started up the car, went back inside, maybe grabbed a book bag or something. And then the second time when he went back out, that's when he was approached. His family says that it was ICE, that they did not have any kind of identification on a jacket or anything like that. Rather, they sort of flashed the badge that they did not see clearly. And then he was taken into custody. He went to the White County Jail. From there, he went to a detention facility out of South Carolina and then ended up in Stewart, which is where he is today. And that is in Georgia. That is a detention facility in Georgia.
You spoke with an ICE spokesman, Brian Cox, who talked with you. And here's the explanation he gave.
Every individual who comes into ICE custody, that case is reviewed by one of ICE's field office leaders. The majority of ICE removals are individuals convicted of a crime. That being said, the Secretary's guidance in the priorities are recent border crossers. We call them border security threats.
In this case, Wilden had not been convicted of any crime.
There's
no criminal activity. It was just this failure to show up at his hearing. So you've been in touch with the family. What's been their reaction and response to this?
Well, the family actually, I think, has been one of the more vocal families in the cases, the handful of cases that we have here in North Carolina. I spoke to the family, I think, the day after, perhaps, and they are in fear. They are very much in fear. They are also very much relying on their faith. You know, one of the sound bites that I will never forget, the mother said, "God is my attorney." And so she is very much praying every day and hoping for a better outcome.
Layla, stay with us. Layla Santiago is a reporter for WRAL-TV. Just ahead, we will have Wilden's mortal lawyer, who is with us today as well. Two immigration lawyers, in fact, will talk about their own experiences along the border as we pursue this case on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, talking about recent raids by Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents. In North Carolina, at least six people who fled Central America have recently been detained. We've just heard about one of them, 19-year-old Wilden Acosta of Durham. ICE officers picked him up in January on his way to Riverside High School. He's currently being held in Georgia while the rest of his family is here in North Carolina. Joining me now is Joanna Goggin. She's an immigration attorney in Raleigh. Hello, Joanna. Good to have you on the program.
Hi, Frank. Thanks for having us.
Also with us is Evelyn Smallwood. She's an immigration attorney in Raleigh, and she represents Wilden Acosta in his deportation case. Welcome back, Evelyn. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Still with us, WRAL's Layla Santiago. So, Evelyn, I know that you can't talk about the details of Wilden's case. It's a legal case. It's still it's still pending. But can you give us an idea about how common his story is?
I think it is incredibly common. I mean, you have to keep in mind that these are this is a surge, as Layla had referenced, and these are tens of thousands of children who have entered the United States recently seeking asylum, seeking protection from the crimes and the violence that is occurring in Central America. And the question obviously becomes, once the children are here, are they able to access due process? Are they able to access the courts? And unfortunately, in a lot of cases, for a lot of reasons, they are unable to do so. And then they are issued, as she also mentioned, removal orders in absentia.
Well, Joanna, tell us more about this, because it sounds like, I mean, as I understand the way asylum seeking works, if you can prove that there is a demonstrable threat to your safety or life in your home country, you may seek asylum and perhaps be granted asylum. Why wouldn't that be true? Is it true in this case, and what would the process be?
Yeah, in many cases, it's actually not true for many of these children. The Department of Homeland Security likes to say that they've had their day in court, but the fact of the matter is due process has really not been carried out in a lot of these cases. Children were not receiving adequate notice of their court dates. For example, a practitioner in Tennessee told me that approximately 100 children that she knows of had the letters informing them of their court dates mailed to them on or after December 21st for court dates that were going to take place January 5th, 6th, or 7th. So if people are visiting relatives for the holidays, or even just if the mail is not completely efficient, they won't receive notice of that hearing date in time.
Well, I wonder again what the test of proof is in these cases. If you say, you know, I'm a 17-year-old young man who was threatened by Barrio 18. I had a choice, either join or die. I'm guessing there's no email, there's no memo, there's no recording of that conversation. I mean, unlike, say, a minority group in a particular place who has been identified and targeted, by the majority. How do you prove that? And has anybody successfully proved that? I guess that's my question.
Yeah, that's a great question. It's extremely difficult to prove. The government, especially with the fast tracking that's taking place, is essentially saying to children, okay, you've made it here. Now we're only going to give you a couple of months to find and pay a lawyer, to assemble documents and evidence, which is extremely difficult, and to prove that you are worthy of protection, and do this all in a language that you do not speak. It's very, very difficult. The kids have to prove, in order to gain asylum, on what basis they have been targeted. They have to obtain documentary evidence from their home country, if possible. And many of the children are not able to meet this burden. Many of them are, particularly when they are given their day in court or their opportunity to appear before the asylum office, which is an office that listens to the asylum cases of unaccompanied children. And that office, the officers there have special training in interviewing children. And it's a non-confrontational position, which means that there's no opposing lawyer opposing the children. And as a result, many children are able to win their cases and win asylum when they take their cases to the asylum office.
Well, Evelyn, is a practical matter. I mean, how do you, what's it like to try to defend and make the case for people in this condition? What are the conditions that you have to work under?
Right. That's also an excellent question. And as Joanna was saying, in order to get asylum, these children actually have to prove that they are being persecuted on account of race, religion, nationality, membership in a particular social group or political opinion, right? So that's where the minutiae kind of come out. So the question becomes, you are, let's using your example, a 17-year-old kid in one of the Northern Triangle countries who is being threatened by a gang. The question becomes, why are you being threatened? Is it because of one of these reasons? Is it something that the government there refuses to control? All of these things are part of proving the asylum case. And quite frankly, as you mentioned, this information is very difficult to come by. Often it is possible to prove an asylum claim based only on testimony of the person who is applying for asylum, whether that be in front of a judge or or the asylum office. But obviously, whenever there is evidence to corroborate the claim, then that is stronger. But unfortunately, generally, when people are being persecuted, particularly on account of one of these reasons, it is unlikely that there is going to be physical, tangible evidence to prove this persecution. And in the event that there is, it's also unlikely that they are going to think to bring it with them when they're fleeing for their lives.
Yeah. And again, if you have if the United States has already recognized a particular minority group or a class of people as being oppressed by a certain set of conditions, you know, it's on the books. But this general violence that we're seeing in certain Latin American countries, I don't think has been recognized in the same way.
That is correct. So what we have seen, and you will see this in the way that the administration is reacting to this surge of people, is that they are stating that this is generalized violence in these countries. And it is one thing to be a victim of a general violence, and it is quite another to be a victim of persecution on account of one of these reasons. But I would say, and I think Joanna could agree with me, that at the heart of asylum law is an analysis on a case-by-case basis. And so while the administration is making decisions based on these people as a whole, at the end of the day, what is necessary for them to be able to qualify for asylum is that their case be heard on the merits on their particular situation. Because just because there's general violence by the gang doesn't mean that this person wasn't persecuted by the gang for one of these reasons.
Yeah, but it sounds like you're in the same bind. If you do that and you say, okay, let's do it on a case-by-case basis, what does Wilden bring to court to prove it?
Well, again, I can't speak generally or I can't speak specifically about that case, but generally that is the problem that we are seeing, right? And honestly, that's another one of the reasons why it is so important. This law is so important that Layla brought up was that it allows children, unaccompanied minors, as Joanna also said, to have their case first heard with the asylum office. And so that's a non-adversarial situation. And they also are specifically trained to deal with children and to deal with children's issues. But again, having access to the asylum office also begins with having good, competent attorneys, which clearly the question also becomes, how do they get attorneys? How do they get to court? How do they make the court know that they're going to be filing their case in the asylum office? I mean, these are all very very difficult procedural and legal problems that attorneys struggle with.
Well, let me ask Joanna, why isn't that the case? Why isn't that office the first stop for each of these cases? Is that up to the individual to figure that out? Or does the United States government say, okay, here's the procedure. Step one, go to the office.
As far as I know, Frank, none of the immigration agencies, the court or Department of Homeland Security, actively and affirmatively tell the children you do have the right, if you enter it as an unaccompanied child, to bring your case to the asylum office, even if you are in removal proceedings in court. And I'd just like to add on to what Evelyn said, if I may. On the one hand, I think that there are really great arguments to say we should consider granting humanitarian relief to anyone who comes from these countries, aside from whether or not they qualify for asylum, to extend TPS, temporary protected status, to individuals from these countries. And on the other hand, currently, since we don't have that in place, many, many of these individuals can qualify for asylum under our existing laws. But one of the biggest factors that makes a difference is whether or not the individual has time, has due process, and has access to an attorney. We've seen that about 75% of cases in which a child is represented by an attorney, the child is allowed to stay in the U.S., whereas in only 15% where they're unrepresented, are they allowed to stay in the U.S.?
Let me ask you, Layla, you've covered this. You've talked to Wildin. Did you get a sense from him? Did you talk with him about what he was going through, kind of how he was thinking and what was going on in his mind when he was being asked these questions? What was the process like for him?
Well, we actually didn't talk too much about the actual, you know, the process when he crossed the border. I actually spent most of my time with him talking about what it was like in the facility where he was right now. What is his state of mind? Because he is in fear, as he told me, to head back to the gangs. And he also talked a little bit about, you know, even if I don't go back directly to my town, to where he's from, which, by the way, is one of the most dangerous areas in Honduras. Even if I don't go back there, I mean, oftentimes I'll get mugged just because I came from the U.S. and people think you have money. So he even talked about that. So he was very much, there was fear, there was uncertainty. He seemed to be like his mother, really relying on faith and really hoping that it would all turn out to be okay.
And what about the process for him? I mean, there hasn't been a final adjudication.
Right. I can tell you that ICE, I asked ICE several questions. One, which was, you know, you heard Brian Cox there saying, look, we're just enforcing the law. These priorities are coming from above, and he is a threat. And I said, I need you to explain to me how an 19-year-old person who has the backing or seems to have the backing of many high school teachers, how is he a threat? He didn't directly answer that question, but continued to state he is a priority, and that means threat for him. But, you know, they had the opportunity to look at his case and see if they wanted to exercise prosecutorial discretion. They opted not to.
Which is to say, and I guess we can go around, I'll start with you, Layla, and then go around. There is some discretion. It's not just our hands are tied. We're following orders here.
Yeah, there is a little bit of pointing the finger, right? ICE will say, well, look, we're just following a judge's orders. And the judge is going to say, well, we didn't get to hear the case, or, you know, there's an in absentia case here. And so ICE at the end of the day has the authority to look at every single case and say, you know what, this is not one that we are going to move forward with. I asked specifically if I could get the numbers on, since the new priorities have gone into effect in November, how many times prosecutorial discretion has been exercised, and those numbers were not released to me. I suspect they might be lower today than they were, you know, 1 or 2 years ago. But those numbers aren't available. But in this case, ICE has spoken. You know, they are not going to exercise prosecutorial discretion for Wildin's case.
What are the priorities? If you have discretion, what is it that you're looking at? Is it a question of national security threat, or is it simply documentation, fail to appear for hearing, a kind of legal framework?
So the new prosecutorial discretion priorities that Layla is referring to were actually published in November of 2014, and they went into effect in January of 2015. And it is something that we refer to as the Johnson memo because it was released by Jay Johnson, who is the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security. And the claim is that they are prioritizing people for deportation who are a threat to the United States. Now, priority one people typically are people who are terrorists, who have committed what are called aggravated felonies. And then there is this nebulous, you know, subsection of priority one that includes people who pose a threat to border security, right? Which is where they are claiming these children go. Priority two are people who have committed other crimes inside the United States, DWIs, burglary, sexual assault, domestic violence, those types of things, or who have multiple low-level misdemeanors. And then the priority three people, I believe, are just typically people who have deportation orders after a certain date. So basically, the administration is using the memo to say, we are going to exercise discretion for these people, except this is the cutoff date, which was a completely arbitrary date. And then everybody else who doesn't fall under that priority theoretically would be able to have exercise or discretion exercised in their case and have the case closed. The claim is that these children, in the event that they don't go to court, in the event that they get a removal order, are falling under priority one. So they are being lumped together with terrorists and with aggravated felons. And if I just may say one more thing, I think that Layla really touched on this. So, and again, also Joanna, just reiterating what she was saying, that in a lot of these cases, these claims have not been heard on the merits. So they might have a deportation order. That does not mean that they would not qualify for asylum under our laws. And even if they do not qualify for asylum under our laws, that does not mean that they will not be killed when they go home.
But what about the argument that, look, you had your day in court and you didn't show up. You had your chance and you weren't there.
I would counter that argument by saying that these are children. And I would also counter that by saying that the 2008 law was put into effect specifically with the purpose to protect children, and that this is a procedural excuse for denying children that protection.
And I would add that there's a memo from the EOIR, which is the sub-agency under which immigration courts fall, from March 2015, that said that children had to be scheduled for their hearing within 10 to 21 days. Now, that is a remarkably short period of time. And like I said earlier, children just did not get sufficient notice. Many of them didn't know. There are documented cases where children were known to be living in California and were given a few days' notice of a hearing requiring them to be in a court in Virginia. It just was not sufficient notice. It wasn't due process.
Well, an irony in all of this is that the uptick in prosecutions and detaining the fact that ICE was launching these raids coincides with the deferred action for childhood arrivals, DACA, which was meant to be a protection for children. And we saw kind of an uptick in both. Talk about that coincidence, maybe, Joanna.
Sure. One thing that's ironic for us immigration practitioners is that President Obama wanted to come out with a number of additional policies to expand DACA to people who had arrived in the U.S. later. DAPA, which would have been a work authorization for parents of citizens. And as part of this series of proposals that he made, one of the proposals was this sort of recategorizing who would be a priority for deportation, for removal that Evelyn just spoke about. Unfortunately, from our point of view, the only part of that series of proposals that's actually gone into effect is the recategorization, which depicts anyone who has entered the U.S. after a certain date as a threat to national security or border security. So none of the positive aspects of the proposal have been able to go into effect, and we're waiting for the Supreme Court to make a decision about that.
And I would just add to that, it also speaks again to kind of the arbitrariness of these priorities and of these proposals. Essentially, President Obama has unilaterally made decisions about immigration policy and has used arbitrary dates and arbitrary numbers in order to determine whether or not people are going to be a priority for deportation. Another good example of this is when you talk about the memo and you talk about the priority two cases, and if a person has a certain number of low-level misdemeanors, or if they're given a certain number of time in jail, or if they've committed certain crimes. And while it's never popular to discuss illegal immigrants or immigrants at all who are here committing crimes, at the end of the day, the priorities that he created are not do not exist under the law. This idea that if you have three or more low-level misdemeanors, then you're a priority for deportation, that is not – that is something that, that he has created. And so legally that's not –
And I wonder, I know that you can't talk about the case in particular, but I wonder if you have any sense at all of when it might be adjudicated or when, you know, the Wilden's case in particular might be settled.
I, again, not talking specifically about his case, but I will say that once you get into, basically, it starts out with these children coming and these children having their court date and having this opportunity to file for asylum with the asylum office. And then once you get into an area where there is a deportation order, when there's an in absentia deportation order, when there's ways to you're trying to get that case reopened, when you're trying to get that case heard on the merits, you're going to be talking about lots of appeals. You're going to talk about a lot of litigation. And so in just generally speaking, that once you have kind of entered that realm of the process, then it's a very long, it's a very drawn out process, which again is one of the reasons why as advocates it is quite discerning that the reaction of ICE has been to detain these people, because essentially that is a an unlimited amount of
there's no way to get out.
You know, we were speaking about ICE. I had the opportunity to be there when ICE was at the Wake County detention facility, and they were talking about the political pressures and decision making. So that, you know, something that tacks on to that decision making.
Well, thank all of you. Layla Santiago is a reporter for WRAL TV. Evelyn Smallwood, an attorney for Wilden Acosta, and Joanna Goggin is also an immigration attorney. Thank all of you for being on the program.
Thank you for having
us. Thank you very much.
Coming up, a new book by sports writer John Feinstein on local coaching legends. Stay tuned.